don't have a quorum yet, but we're going to just get started here because it's past the 1 o'clock hour. So we have first on our list of the Minnesota Historical Society. If you guys want to come forward, I will interrupt you once we get quorum, though. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Stephen Elliott. I'm the director of the Minnesota Historical Society.
Mr. Elliott, I'm going to pause you right there. We got our last one here. I'm going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order. Members, in your packet, you have two sets of minutes, the February 1st set of minutes and February 7th. Representative Kunesh Podin, would you like to move those minutes?
I so move.
Representative Kunesh Podin moves the minutes for February 1st and February 7th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes are adopted. Okay, with that, members, we are going to start off with the Historical Society. Mr. Elliott, you introduced yourself, so you're covered there, but if you want to start proceeding with the rest of your testimony, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm joined today by my colleagues, Peggy Ingeson, who is our Chief Administration and Finance Officer, and David Kelleher, whom I think you all know, our Director of Public Policy. And we deeply appreciate the opportunity to present the Minnesota Historical Society's fiscal year 2018-19 budget request. We appreciate the opportunity to introduce the Minnesota Historical Society and talk a little bit about all the work that we do. A few quick facts. When the first territorial legislature of Minnesota got together, one of their first acts was to charter the Minnesota Historical Society. We're the oldest educational institution in Minnesota. We're guided by charters from 1849 and 1856. We are governed by a governing board called the Executive Council, and our statutory responsibilities are set forth in Chapter 138 of the Minnesota Statutes. Our mission is to use the power of history to transform lives. And we do that by preserving material, sharing that material, and connecting the past with today and connecting people today with each other. We do this in a number of ways, reaching a wide group of audiences who learn in different ways. Our slogan that you will see on buttons and on our material is that history matters. Since our predecessors thought ahead to ensure preservation of our history, our responsibility is to pay it forward and preserve today's history for future generations. History is the context for the world that we live in today. It's the context for the issues we grapple with today and for the world that our children and grandchildren live in tomorrow. Some of the core functions that are essential to our government and to our society include preserving and making accessible and meaningful to people today evidence of the past, evidence that includes our state archives, which is cared for by the Minnesota Historical Society, historic preservation activities, preserving the cultural landscape of Minnesota, and, of course, a wide range of educational activities. We provide educational opportunities for lifelong learners, young people, older folks, folks in classrooms, folks seeking us by coming to our sites, and folks accessing our material online. We're an important part of the tourism economy in Minnesota. Surveys show that tourists want to visit interesting, unique places. This includes historic sites and museums. We're an important part of the state's billion-dollar tourism economy, and cultural tourists stay longer in their destinations and spend more money. We offer learning opportunities in a wide variety of learning methods, from our historic sites and museums, 26 of them in Minnesota, our exhibitions at our sites and exhibitions we prepare that travel, public programming, education, and library and collections, including our research collections, reference support, and the state archives. We also operate the State Historic Preservation Office and provide field services and technical assistance support to the literally hundreds of history and heritage organizations across Minnesota and operate grant programs that support them. And we have an extensive publishing program. We're the state's oldest book publisher, and our publishing today also consists of online publishing, and 5 million people access our online materials each year. Our governing board adopted these strategic priorities, which we have focused on over the last several years, and we're now in the process of assessing our progress on these priorities and restating the priorities for the years ahead. And with that background, I would like to turn to my colleague, Mr. Kelleher, to talk in more detail about some of the work we do.
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. As Steve mentioned, one of our important statewide functions is our historic sites network that is outlined in statute and contains over 140 structures that we're charged with taking care of, as well as interpreting the stories embodied in those sites to the public. This is an important part of our educational mission, but also an important part of our budget to take care of those structures and the staffing required to open the doors to the public. We collect things as outlined in this slide, and these are not simply items that are stashed away in a warehouse. They're used by family historians, students, including History Day students, scholars, legal researchers, academics, and many others. And you can see the broad array of collections, photographs, publications, objects, and other items that are in the collections. As a statewide organization, we're proud to welcome nearly 1 million in-person visitors to our historic sites and museums each year, and a large segment of those visitors are school children, and we'll talk in a minute about Northern Lights, our Minnesota Studies curriculum. In addition, we provide information on Minnesota history to millions of visitors, 5 million visitors, on our website each year. As mentioned, speaking of school children, one of the products that we're very proud of is Northern Lights, the Minnesota Studies textbook, and we can pass that around. We have a couple of copies. Thanks. This is the Minnesota Studies, which includes Minnesota history, geography, economics, and civics, that's used by 75% of our state's sixth graders. This book, which now has a digital edition, is the starting point for curriculum and a connecting point for field trips, in which teachers can connect what they do on field trips to what they do in the classroom with activities that are in the book and also supplemental activities. In addition, we have extensive training on Northern Lights for teachers so that they can make the most of using this resource effectively and be better teachers. A few more reflections of the high levels of participation in history activities in Minnesota. We have 27,000 participants in History Day, which is the history project competition which students from across the state participate in, and then we send usually about 50 or 60 kids to National History Day, and we will do a little bragging. We do more than our fair share of National History Day winners. For a relatively small state, we bring home the medals at National History Day. We have 25,500 members who help to support our operations both financially and with their participation in our activities. And this makes us the largest state historical society in the country in terms of membership. And volunteers really make this all happen. We have 2,500 wonderful volunteers who give their time, and interns as well, who give their time to help with staffing special projects, special events. Their time commitment each year is 71,000 hours. And really, this is, if you quantify that, that comes out to about 25 or 26 full-time equivalents. So that helps us to extend the reach that we are able to make with the resources that we do have. And as you all know from your other lives, volunteers take recruitment, retention, and recognition. It's easy to overlook those factors. With that, we'll take a closer look at some of the financial aspects, and my colleague Peggy Ingerson will take it from here.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. Peggy Ingerson, Chief Financial Officer for the Historical Society. Slide 12, for those of you who are maybe following along in the budget book, this ties out and reconciles a little bit with page 8 in the budget book. This is our effort to kind of simplify for you a little bit our various funding sources. Both Steve and David talked about how we leverage the state funds. And so what you'll see here is the general funds making up a large portion of our funding, the arts and cultural heritage funds, a significant slice, and then what we call the miscellaneous agency fund. These are the revenues that we collect for things like our earned revenue when we collect admission fees at historic sites, revenue from book publishing, our contributions and membership. So all of the funds, and some of these are restricted by donor as well, the funding, but this is all shown under that miscellaneous agency. The next slide shows an overview of our funding programs and shows you a little bit of a breakout of how the funds are spent among the various functions that we have and programs inside the organization. You can see that we translate the state general fund dollars into roughly $4 per citizen in Minnesota funding and supporting the Historical Society. Our full-time equivalents are 444, but we actually have a headcount approaching 700 because we have a fair amount of our workforce that is part-time. The next slide is just a brief summary of the recommendations. The governor has recommended the same level of funding from the general fund as our current funding level. But we also have a couple of initiatives that we want to just briefly bring to your attention going forward in the next 2 years. The operating adjustment, $1.5 million for compensation and general inflationary costs of operations. The Digital Preservation and Access Fund, and members of this committee, I think, have had some knowledge and visited the Historical Society as we've talked about our need to preserve the digital content that's being created now and making sure that that's accessible to the public, that great deal of infrastructure costs needed for that change in format. And then lastly, we have an initiative for diversity and inclusion. This has been a part of our strategic plan for strategic priorities for the last few years, and we'd like to take this to a new level, recognizing the diversity of population in Minnesota and our need to collect and tell stories of a broader group. So those are the funds that we've requested for increase. The next slide is a summary of the page 3 in your, ties out to page 3 in your budget book, and this is just showing the breakout of the budget by program. We are largely talking to you about the Historical Society operations and programs. That's the main operations of the Historical Society. But we have two other programs. One is the Historic Preservation Grant in Lieu of Credit. This is a tax credit that we administer, and users of this tax credit have the option to receive a grant that flows through our organization. This is shown as an open appropriation in the general fund and is forecast. Lastly, there's the fiscal agent program, where there are a number of smaller organizations that receive funding through the Minnesota Historical Society. The next chart shows a breakout by funding source, and this ties out to a page in your budget book as well, but you'll see the general fund, the largest portion there on the top, and then the statutory appropriation, or if you will, the open appropriation for the historic tax credit. The special revenue fund is a modest source of funding that we get for fees administering the historic grant program. And then you'll see the legacy funds, and the difference between the current biennium and the next one is that the legacy funds are one-time funding. And then lastly, all of the non-state funds, we've lumped them all together, our earned revenue and contributed funds, to give you a picture of how this fits with the context of the overall funding of the organization. Wrapping.
Madam Chair, we would conclude with this statement from former Governor Elmer Anderson, who was a great champion and supporter of the Minnesota Historical Society, and who describes here the important role that the Society has played and will continue to play in the well-being of our state and our communities. And with that, we would be happy to try to field your questions, including any questions you may have about our response to the letter sent by you, Madam Chair, and Senator Kiffmeyer. And a quick word on that. If we could leave you with one thought related to that document, it would be that the Historical Society is able to leverage our very important state funding with support from the public and from generous Minnesotans and organizations. All of that helps us to deliver a better overall Minnesota history product to more people. And I would just hasten to add that the state support is the essential foundation for what we are able to do operationally. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Elliott, and thank you, Mr. Kelleher. I can tell you that I certainly appreciate all the hard work. My family, my children have certainly used all of these resources, as well as the students that I've taught. So thank you very much. Are there questions then? I think Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have to tell you, I am very impressed by the book. I wish I had that in sixth grade. We were required as a year-long project to do a book on Minnesota. Of course, I did it the night before. And but that is a great tool for students. And I do want to reiterate, I do think it's very important for us to be databasing all of the information that transpires in government. I think that's smart for us. We can only learn from the past. So I appreciate your guys' efforts to keep that data and all the work that you've done on that piece. And so that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Nash, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Elliott, I looked at the sheet you provided for us on executive compensation. Your salary is $291,445 a year plus $45,704 in benefits. Can you give us the breakdown where all that money comes from? And do that for all of the folks listed here.
Surely. By statute, the salaries at the Historical Society tie the state scale with the exception of the directors. So, of course, as with any good not-for-profit, our governing board takes a hard look at that, forms a compensation committee that does research on the market for CEOs of major history organizations, and they set my compensation and to be competitive. I believe that there's state funds to a limit in my salary, and the rest come from the other funds that come to the Minnesota Historical Society.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
If you would detail for us what the state amount for your salary is and the state amount for your benefits are, and then we'll go from there after that.
Director Elliott.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative, we look at the governor's salary generally and try to spend no more than the amount of the governor's salary, even though that's not a requirement for us, on the director's salary. So it's about one-third is paid for with state funds and two-thirds with other funding sources.
And Madam Chair, that wasn't exactly answered the way I was hoping. If you could give us the detail of what the exact amount of the state funding for the salary is.
I'm sorry, Representative, I'll have to look at the exact funding as it is today, but we generally look at the percentages and tie it out to you know, it's roughly $120,000 that is state funds and the balance from other donor funds.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And if you would also, if you don't have it today, if you could detail the others listed on the executive compensation and for the organization, you could get that to Chair Anderson, myself. That would be great. Mr. Holtquist would be able to receive that as well. I'm just very curious as to how we arrive at that, particularly given, I think it was last year, we talked about a lot of commissioners' salaries and such, and Minnesotans would like to know how people that work for the state are compensated and what formulas and derivatives that we come up with, because, you know, on paper, it's an eye-popping number, $24,000 a month. So if you would, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Paul?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Pardon me?
No problem. Thank you all for being here. As you know, I'm a fan of the History Center, and I love your logo, History Matters. I totally agree. I'd want to echo my experience with the textbook. I've had the opportunity to teach the civics section from the book at Minnetonka, and the kids are so interested and fascinated, and it's just an awesome book. I noticed in the book that was passed around that this one is the revised second edition, and I'm wondering when that came out and what the specifics of the changes were, if maybe it's just minor, between the one that I think I have and this revised second edition.
May I ask Mr. Kelleher to respond to that,
please? Oh, yes, please. Mr. Kelleher?
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, the edition that we circulated around the table was published in 2013, and it had updates throughout the document. I think some of the notable changes are the Minnesota Studies, which is the civics, economics, and geography, as well as we are moving beyond just having a book. So we have, since the publication of the book that's gone around the table, we have a digital edition because, as you know, many schools use iPads in the classroom, so there's a digital iPad edition of the book. And what's really cool is that the iPad edition can go so much further beyond what a book can do. So if you have a timeline or a map, you can tap on that resource, and the timeline can expand, the map can expand, you can hear voices of history, we can do oral histories and do recordings, and you can have those embedded in the iPad edition. So it's more than just a book now. It's a whole suite of products that we can use to teach kids, and I guess I would say I pick up Northern Lights every once in a while to refresh my memory on chapters of Minnesota history. So it's not just for sixth graders.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, and thank you for that. That was a question. I was busy looking at all the materials that you gave us when you were talking about that digital version, so I'm just really excited to check that out on my iPad as well. And then I have one more unrelated question, Madam Chair.
Yep, Representative.
Thank you. My question is with regard to the capital project that you have before us or being considered, and I'm wondering if any legacy funds could be used for a capital project such as the one that the Historical Society has come up with, and if any legacy funds have been used in the past for any capital projects.
I would like to respond to that and ask Mr. Kelleher if he would care to supplement. But traditionally, the state has taken care of the capital needs of the state's historic sites network. And so to use legacy funds would go against the language and intent of a legacy amendment, which is intended not to use legacy funds to supplant what has been the normal funding source for work. So legacy funds have not been used for this because traditionally the state has taken care through bonding bills of the capital needs of the sites. And David, would you like to elaborate?
Madam Chair, the only thing I would add to that is that what Steve described is a requirement in the constitutional language of the amendment. So that's a pretty high bar that we have to meet in the supplement substitute requirement.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions? Any other questions? Well, wonderful. Thank you for your report, and thank you for all the hard work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Next on our agenda is the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board Financial and Budget Presentation. And this afternoon, testifying will be Paul Mandel, the Executive Secretary.
It's all you.
Wow. Thank you. All right, gentlemen, would you like to begin your presentation?
Madam Chair, Paul Mandel, Executive Secretary for the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. Today I have with me my Principal Planner and Zoning Administrator.
Peter Musty, Principal Planner.
Thank you.
Zoning Administrator.
Madam Chair, we are neither as old nor as big as the Historical Society, but this year we are celebrating the 50th year of our existence. We were created by the legislature to report directly to the legislature. The Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board, when we meet with small agencies, I always joke because our title is longer than our staff is deep. We are three staff people. Our most recent success is working with the Historical Society and the Administration Department on the Capitol Building that you've all hopefully been able to enjoy and not get lost in. The agency, as I said, was created in 1967. It's a small non-cabinet planning and regulatory body responsible for architectural design and long-range planning in the Capitol area. Our statute is 15B. The board's mission is twofold. First, to preserve and enhance the dignity, beauty, and architectural integrity of the Capitol and the Capitol area's unique character. And secondly, to help plan and guide its future development by maintaining a flexible framework for its physical growth. We are a 12-member board chaired by the Lieutenant Governor. We have four gubernatorial appointees, three mayoral appointees, and four legislators serving on the board. Senators include Carla Nelson and Sandy Pappas. Representatives include Representatives Dean and Dean. We meet roughly on a quarterly basis or every 2 to 3 months as needed. Because of our zoning functions, if we have a zoning application that must come before the board, we have to meet within 60 days by state statute. You have before you, I believe, copies of our biennial report. And I'll just run through that very, very quickly. We have our land use planning and zoning. We have design review and architectural competitions. These would kick in most often with the memorials on the Capitol grounds or in state buildings, the Historical Society. The History Center and the Judicial Center were both done by architectural competitions run by our office. Otherwise, we cooperate in design build, if that's the case, or in a hybrid, which was the case when we selected the architectural team for the Capitol building using a hybrid design selection group. We then work with the Department of Administration in the case of the Capitol building, the Historical Society, because we have jurisdiction along with the Historical Society over all the public spaces in the Capitol. So it was regular reviews and climbing the scaffold to approve and examine the artwork, the paintings, et cetera, in the public spaces. One of the things that we set up early on in that project was to make sure that the architectural integrity of the Capitol building was guaranteed. That was the first and foremost design criteria. After that, it was the functions of the Capitol building must be improved to support government processes, and then life safety and security must also be addressed. We have a centerfold there with some pictures of the Capitol building in various stages of restoration during the project, and as well as reviewing some of the individual projects that took place with regard to the art, the stone, the windows, as well as memorials, the new Senate office building, the new parking structures, both in the Senate and behind the DOT. And then we have the comprehensive plan that every 10 years we review and revisit our comprehensive plan, and with it, the zoning ordinance governing the 60-block area that the Capitol area is comprised of. About half of that is state-owned properties with state buildings and or public spaces or open spaces. The rest of it is privately developed, residential, Bethesda, Health East, Sears Complex, and the commercial areas of Wright Street. So we're setting into that motion now. Peter's been working and coordinating efforts between the City of St. Paul, Met Council, Department of Administration, and other bodies, including Metro Transit, to look at different aspects of what would be considered transportation management, travel demand management, zoning, and is about to work on, the city is looking at Wright Street as a redevelopment area, along with the county looking at a capital improvement to Wright Street from University Avenue North past our boundaries. And with that, I would open ourselves up to questions if you have any.
Yes. First, we have Representative Vogel with a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the financial information,
yes.
Looking at the operating expense, noticed that it seemed to have jumped a lot from the previous 3 years. We were $62,000, $66,000, $56,000, and then all of a sudden $121,000. Just curious what might have made that difference.
Are you looking at one of the pages we received?
I'm looking at page 3 of the this.
Oh, okay. Give me just a minute.
Sure.
Thank you. I believe that was Madam Chair, Representative, I think that was the year. We had a fluke of a year where the state legislature appropriated $325,000. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Oh, right. One of the things that I explained in our answers to the questions from Representative Anderson, we have had since 14, I came on board in 14, and at times between 14 and now until just this past month, we have been a staff of either 1 to 3 people. So it's been widely fluctuating. We've had vacancies, and so we've been widely fluctuating, spending far less in 1 year, et cetera. The 121 in 17, that has not been spent yet. A lot of that has not been spent. We have, if you look at our sheets, we have about $53,000 right now that's unallocated or unencumbered, et cetera. And that is as a result of some of the money that has not been spent as far as employees, et cetera, benefits, and other costs. We purposely, because I was all by myself for at least several months each time we had a vacancy, we weren't having regular meetings other than the board. We weren't having regular advisory meetings, et cetera. We weren't doing any of the zoning outreach the proactive work that we would normally do if we had been fully staffed at that time. But I believe that's an estimate that has not, that includes $53,000 at this point that has not yet been spent. It's an estimate for 17. In 14 and 15, we turned over $40,000 at the end of our fiscal year to the Odyssey Fund. I don't know if you folks are familiar with the Odyssey Fund. It's an IT fund that you can take. It was legislatively authorized. I think that was the first year it was done, where if you had costs that you knew that were going to be IT-related and you had a balance at the end of your fiscal year, you could put the leftover, rather than return to the general fund, you could put it into the basically transfers into Minute. And at this point, we're waiting for approval. In that case, that was $40,000. We're waiting for approval, and it will be going towards creating a digital backup of all of our files as part of the COOP, or emergency preparedness. We have no backup to our paper files. It would also go to purchasing a scanner so we could supplement those files once they're scanned, and also purchasing a SketchUp, which is a software package. And we're also converting with that money to Tridion, which is the state website. We had a website that was developed back in 06 and 07, but the state has converted most of their websites to Tridion. So that year, that biennium, we had $40,000 left over. This year, we'll probably have a similar amount because we haven't been spending it on employee expenses and other related expenses.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a follow-up, I don't know what kind of detail might be available, but it might be nice if a little more detail. I realize, you know, asking a specific question like that sometimes is difficult, but maybe just providing the detail of maybe the last, since 14, just to see, you know, what the actual expenditures were for operating expenses, because the compensation has been growing somewhat, but it was just that jump in operating expense. So maybe just the detail would be helpful if we could get that.
I think if you go to the pages that we sent to Representative Anderson, you'll see most of our operating expenses, other than rent and IT, everything is literally $1,000 and $2,000. But I'll look into that 121 because I suspect that includes the 53,000 lump sum that's still out there that's unencumbered. I'll get more detail for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Mandel. Next, we have Representative Nash with questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to start with our IT questions of the day. You're contracting with Minute. Your 16 spend is $73.35, and then you're projecting a drop of over 50% for 17. Kind of walk me through that, what you're using, what you're not using, and then we'll go from there.
Mr. Mandel.
And then as you're looking, part of the question is, that's spread over utilization of how many people in your office?
Three people.
Okay.
The drop, excuse me, I'm drinking. Madam Chair, Representative Nash, I think the drop at I'm sorry, what page are you looking at?
I'm looking at your secondary handout.
Right. Okay.
And I'm on page 3 of 8.
Yep.
CAPB, Interagency, Paying Agency, Capital Area Architecture and Planning Board, Page 2, Admin, Minute, Public Safety.
Oh, I see. Okay. What I believe is the case is that it's just, that's where we are right now. We'll be spending the full $7,000 by the end of the year.
Okay, so this is a year-to-date?
Correct. That's my understanding.
Okay. And Madam Chair, follow-up to that, what is your projected contribution or spend on that for the cybersecurity piece that's being spread across various Minute subscribers? You can break that out. Nothing?
I don't know that detail at all.
Okay.
We go through, Madam Chair, Representative Nash, we go through SMART. All of our bills are paid through SMART.
Okay.
So I never see that itemization at that level. Okay. Then in 18 and 19, it's projected to go up to 11 and 13.
Okay, Madam Chair, another question on this.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is almost an inconsequential number, but $10 to public safety. I'm just curious.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, because of the changes in personnel, we've had four different employees get four different employee badges. And that's what we pay public safety for, employee badges.
I I had to know. I was grasping at straws. I had no idea. So, all right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Mandel. Thank you, Mr. Nash. Any other questions?
I have
one. All right. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, you mentioned that you all your invoices and all your payments are made through SMART. Was that correct? What is your process for reconciliation of those bills before you authorize SMART to pay them?
Madam Chair, Representative, when they come into our office, or in the case of Minute, when they come through the COSWEB, which goes to the SMART and then comes to us to okay to pay, we check then on making sure that those cover expenses that we have incurred or bills that we have sent purchase orders through the process for. If so, then we okay to pay those. In the case of other bills that would be through vendors, and we have, I'll say, somewhere between 10 and 12, maybe 15 bills a month. We would get the vendor notices. We wait for the actual packing slips or the invoice itself. We clear it through both our office assistant, and then I approve it. It goes up to SMART. They pay it, and then it comes back to us as a paid expense on a monthly basis, and we check those.
Follow up.
Yes.
Director, what do you do if you have some disputed billing? What happens, and how does that process work with SMART?
Madam Chair, Representative, we are co-located in Department Administration Building. So in this case, it's a very, very convenient relationship. We just go upstairs and have a meeting with them and try to reconcile where the differences were.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mandel. Thank you, Representative. Next, we have Representative Lilly with a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find this really interesting. I didn't realize your area was so huge, the Capitol Mall area. You know, I'm just it's way beyond what you would think of just traditionally the Capitol itself. I just wanted to say I think we're all enjoying the benefits of the last couple of years of the improved Capitol and getting back in there and see it. I noticed on the stone repair, the Minnesota granite is diamond pink, and I guess I'd never noticed any pink to that granite, so I was just curious about that. But and you're hoping to be done this fall with the Capitol, and then personally, I enjoyed I think it's good how you use the legacy money and the bonding money to improve the art as well and preserve that. And I don't know what your involvement was with opening up the front area, but I think all us members, I hope we are able to get out there in the spring. The Senate has an advantage over us where they can have a retiring room off their or a outside area patio off of their retiring room, and we really don't have one off of other than a very small area. And sometimes it's nice and healthy probably for all of us to get outside for a few seconds, so hopefully that's open in the spring when we have some extended sessions, and I'm guessing that you had something to do with that, so and hopefully that's open to us as members and beyond. It really is important addition to have that reopen. And then you talk on some of your words in here about the Cass Gilberts and, you know, to be respectful of his design intent. And I'm certain that was part of his design intent to have that open to the public. So, and I'm glad that's up and running. But anyways, I think good job overall. And we're all seeing treasures that we might not have seen before with the new renovation and freshened up of the old one. So thank you.
And Madam Chair, just I would be remiss if I was not to share the credit. The legacy dollars for the artwork, the Historical Society is heavily involved, and they are the final arbiter for any art relocation, et cetera. We had supplied, as it's hopefully clear in my submittal in response to Representative Anderson's letter, we were allocated authorized through legislation at the end of 2008 the license plates and the book sales, the cookbook sales from the sesquicentennial for the Capitol were then rededicated over to the Capitol Board for purposes of the Capitol building. And so that was a transfer of roughly $97,000 and another $93,000 and another $7,000 toward the assessment for the art. The original project scope did not include some of the fine art. It included all the decorative art that you still see being worked on, but it did not include the fine art. And the Historical Society and the Cap Board went to work on making sure that that was addressed. Fortunately, Representative Erdahl came to our rescue with legacy dollars, and we had over $3 million of legacy dollars going into that. And being up close and 100 feet in the above the rotunda and the scaffold, looking inches away from that artwork, gave me a true appreciation for just how different it was before and after. And in the old days, I mean, we would go up there, and in the old days when they had a bad plaster piece, they just cut through the canvas and shove new plaster in and new glue. It was just amazing that the damage that had been done to those murals. With regard to the house space to spread out, I believe at least one of the doors off your retiring room will allow you to be out on the smaller balcony. I remember many a day when Representative Oskop and Representative Ruckavina, and it was like, if you, with all due respect, it was like Mud and Jeff, and they would be out on the balcony. But in addition, the new loggia, which is on the second floor on the front, has now been made walkable. It has a high enough rail so it's code compliant, and the new doors will allow for handicapped access out to that balcony. So that is also a new addition. And as far as the front parking lot, that the House always used to have a bill to get rid of Senate parking, that was a long-term goal of the Cap Boards. We had plans as far back as the early 80s when I came on board in 87 of turning into a pedestrian space much like Gilbert had wanted. Now back then they had horse and carriages, and the old streetcars went across the mall instead of LRT going behind. But that was done, and Representative Nash knows this well, having served on the Capitol Security Task Force, that a lot of that was done out of security measures, and there are there's a bonding request for some of that, but there are also many measures, and it was determined that from Homeland Security standpoint, that should not be parked on. So we are very, very grateful that that has finally gotten to the point where it was in design.
Great. Thank you for that. Next we have Representative Detmer.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Mandel, could you explain to the committee here on how do you go about funding the maintenance of the Capitol Grounds memorials? There's several memorials around there, and also, do you have any new projects in the works too? But how do you go about in terms of funding the maintenance of these projects?
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, ever since when I first came on board, the memorials were none, basically. We had the Court of Honor with the plaques for each of the wars and other incidences related to armed service members. First was the Vietnam Memorial, then the Korean Veterans Memorial, and now we've got a number of them out there. After about the third memorial, we realized at first we were having a 10% dedicated fund that went into plant management dedicated to that project only. Usually it was private dollars, so it would be interest-bearing. And then we changed it, I think, in 96 to 20% of the construction budget. This is not for the planting and cleaning the algae or whatever, but actual repairs of stone if it starts to fail, or structures such as the Peace Officers Memorial has gone through numerous times with these steel hangers for the granite. As I said, that's an upfront charge that we give to any client group that comes through, be it through the legislature or otherwise, where 20% of the construction budget must be reserved and must be on hand before we put out the bids. Right now we have a Medal of Honor Memorial that we'll be reusing, and we came to the legislature last year for authorization. There was no appropriation at the time. To reuse the pool down by the Veterans Court of Honor, the statue that's there, used to have water flowing out of it into the air, and it used to collect water, but the pool leaks, so it's been off for at least 10 or 12 years. And we have a new design that Representative Detmer was involved in that will reincorporate that into, instead of a pool, it'll be a zero-gravity, what they call zero-gravity or zero-depth water feature. So the water would spill out at the base of the pool. So you could, if you put your finger in it, it's like the Martin Luther King Memorial in Birmingham, where if you put your finger in it, you interrupt the flow of the water, but there's no collection of water, and then it recirculates through stones in the bottom back into the water. So it's a constantly recirculating, but no standing water. So there's no life safety issues. There's no issues of, and it's on polished granite. So that would be when it's dry in the winter and the water is turned off, it would look just as positive as it does when it, the water is flowing over it. That is the only memorial we have right now in the hopper. But there is a, in the governor's bonding request, there's a request for $350,000 to repair two of the memorials. That's part of an estimated $2.5 million to bring all of them up to a point of safety and complete repair so that we start with a good baseline from which to move forward in the future. And some of that is disheveled sidewalks to plantings to rehanging some of the memorial granite pieces, et cetera, like that. So that's a long-term project that's been carried in the last two bonding cycles.
Thank you. Follow up?
Thank you.
All right. Next we have Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, on the Sears block, what do you picture there? Anything other than parking?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we have had, because our body has the zoning authority versus the city, because we oversee, as a state agency, we oversee, we've had two approaches from this. Sears building is now leased by Sears. The property itself is owned by Seritage, which was originally a spinoff from Sears and is now a free independent body that they own numerous Sears properties, and Sears leases back from them for the building. Both plans called for high-density residential, five to six-story. That's the maximum height we allow in the district. Nothing can be taller than the Capitol cornice. Mixed-use commercial development, office buildings, and structured parking facilities. So in both cases, the entire wherever you see the asphalt, it's all filled in. And the Sears building either continues to exist in the center of it all, or a new Sears building is built apart, and then it's all, again, filled in. But it's there is no surface parking when everything is said and done. They are out marketing those plans right now for residential and commercial to see what goes forward. It's been about 2 or 3 years since we've heard from them last, but we keep in touch with them at least on a yearly basis, and they're still out marketing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sounds like a nice improvement.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? I just have two thoughts or two suggestions in order to get folks to come and enjoy the artwork that we have at our Capitol and these different memorials. Have you ever thought about planting GPS, what do they call them, GPS, geocap, yeah, and then in order for folks to follow that around. But what about having, like, a QR code next to all the pieces of art or the memorials that folks can just take their phone with that app and get some of the historical information?
Madam Chair, again, I would be remiss if I wasn't still in the room. Historical Society has both printed guides and a smart guide that your phone can pick up for not only the art in the Capitol building itself, they make it into like a treasure hunt, but also all the memorials that have been built on the Capitol grounds. We've worked with them to develop the text for that. We have also started to incorporate into the more recent memorials a QR code. And the problem with the QR code or any of that, and we have links on our website also to these, is it's only as good as this, the website that's developed around that memorial. So. As long as the client group is going to have further information, we don't want to send somebody to a place that doesn't have any information. But the Historical Society has already thought of that. They have both the smartphone guides and printed guides for both the mall and the Capitol building.
Great. Wonderful. Any questions? Anything else? Well, then we are adjourned. Thank you.